Okie doke. So, welcome to Introduction to Clinical Bioethics. I'm Autumn Feaster, and hopefully you're in the right class. Now would be your exit time. So I imagine everybody's grabbed the syllabus, and I imagine there'll be some stragglers, and I know there were quite a few people who weren't able to be here tonight. They'll join us next time, and also I'll tell you a lot about the way that the class is structured, but the sections between Tuesday and Thursday will vary significantly week to week, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. So this is our game plan tonight. I'm going to go over the syllabus, nitty-gritty, and all of that kind of thing. And then we're going to get right to the content area for the first week, and I'm going to talk about the legal cases in the end of life. Mostly, I'm going to be talking tonight exclusively about withdrawal of care cases. And then in the next few weeks, as we look at the syllabus, you'll see this, we will be talking about physician-assisted suicide cases. There were specifically two that went before the Supreme Court, and each of those two physician-assisted suicide cases correspond to a very classic piece in bioethics, so we'll look at those two legal cases as the framework for the sessions that we do on physician-assisted suicide. So tonight, we'll really be talking about the legal cases in withdrawing end-of-life care. Okay, but first, let's walk through all of the nitty-gritty stuff about the semester. Come on in. I'm going to put a pile of syllabi. You will not be the last person in, for sure, especially since we trek all the way up to market for the class. So we'll probably have stragglers for a while. Let's talk about some of the things that are unique about this class, and just grab a syllabus and just find a place. Syllabus. Or that way too. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Before I do that, I should probably introduce myself a little bit more thoroughly because I am seeing a lot of new faces. I am the Director of Education here in the Master of Bioethics program. I am a moral philosopher by training, so I have a philosophical approach to bioethics, and that should not frighten you because my job in this introduction class is to presuppose nothing, to presuppose no philosophical background, though my guess is some of you have quite a substantial background in philosophy. That is absolutely not a prerequisite. And in fact, though this is a 600-level class, my job is to get everyone to the level where you can make an argument, a compelling argument, and understand how arguments in bioethics work, to critique them and to make them yourself. So it is a philosophically oriented class, but it is not a class that requires any philosophy background, and I will be doing the work of helping you understand the material and then helping you be able to replicate bioethics arguments, I mean, create them on your own. The areas that I work in bioethics are moral theory and how it applies to bioethics, but specifically I work in clinical ethics. And this class has the title Introduction to Clinical Bioethics to differentiate it from the vast area of bioethics that is about research ethics. So this is really about patients and physicians as opposed to science and researchers. And there is a class, Introduction to Research Ethics, that happens in the spring, which you're welcome to take. So I will not be talking about trials and therapeutic misconception and coercion of subjects. That will all be in the spring. But I will be talking about a lot of philosophical or conceptual bioethical issues that hit the clinical arena. And the areas that I work in addition to this, if I specify the areas in clinical bioethics, I work in LGBT bioethics, and I also work in mediation as an approach to clinical ethics consultation that challenges the orthodoxy in the way that clinical ethics tends to be practiced in the United States. And you'll get to hear more about that actually on the last day of class. All right, that is me. Let's talk about the class itself. The first thing to note about this class is that it is very flexible, and I offer it on purpose on Tuesdays and Thursdays so that it's convenient for you to take it either Tuesday or Thursday, depending on what your schedule is like that week. So it doesn't make any difference what class you're actually signed up for, though it does tend to be the case that Tuesday is a more popular day for folks to take classes than Thursday. So if you like a smaller section, Thursday should be your target, because Tuesday will probably be significantly larger. But that is entirely up to you, and you need never tell me what your plan is. In fact, the class is really large. Introduction to Clinical Bioethics and syllabi right there. Grab one. Because the class is actually larger than this, the room helps you think it's very small, and the fact that it's on two nights makes you think it's quite small. It turns out it's actually quite large, and so if everybody told me when they were going to come on Tuesday and Thursday, I probably have a full-time job managing my email. So you need never tell me what you're doing Tuesday or Thursday. You do it as you choose and works out for you. One thing you do want to note is that this syllabus tells you when I'm doing what lecture on which Tuesday and which Thursday, and it will behoove you to take note of which lecture will be on which Tuesday and Thursday so that you don't end up coming and hearing legal issues and end of life twice and not anything about physician-assisted suicide. So just pay attention to the days of the week on the syllabus when I'm doing the various lectures, and then you just mix and match as is appropriate for you. So that's the first reason why this class is incredibly flexible, because you can come either Tuesday, Thursday, or mix and match. That's one. Two, as you can see from the little gadget here, we record all of our classes. And so if you can't come, you can listen to it. And we put all of the material, and I will speak to this for a second here, on the website, the courses, what we call Blackboard. And I know for many of you, that is old hat, and you are very familiar with what that all means. But for those of you who don't know what Blackboard is, I'm going to give a little mini. Hi, come on in, come on in. Grab a syllabus. You're not the last people, I'm certain of it. And the first 5 minutes, I'm talking about how flexible the course is and all this. The one thing that I want to assure you is it never matters to me if you're late. I never take it personally. I never think, well, it's because I'd rather not listen to an extra 5 minutes of Autumn. I never think that. I know that the reason you're late is because you have other important things to do, or just because you're a procrastinator. And, hey, I'm married to one. So I don't care that you're late. Don't ever be worried, and you don't have to tiptoe in. Just come right on in and find a seat. But for what you have missed, it's on the recording. Okay, I'm at the part of the pitch about the class where I'm telling you that that recording that you're going to need, because you will probably all miss class at some point, and maybe frequently, that recording will be on the website we call Blackboard. And for those of you who have been in school here at Penn or in other institutions for a long time, again, this is a very obvious thing to talk about, but some of you are returning students, haven't been students for quite a while, and maybe when you were a student, there were things like course packs and other things that don't exist. And others of you are looking at me very wide-eyed because you don't know what I mean. You don't know what a course pack is. It was a bulk thing that you got from like Kiko's. And is that the name of that place? You know, it's like a printing place. You paid a whole lot of money for it, like $75, and all the reading was in there, and that's how it used to be done. Well, it isn't done that way anymore. Now, if you go to the Penn website, just, you know, put Penn into your browser, and you get the little corner up to put some in, you know, some search, type the word Blackboard, and that will take you to the part of the Penn Library system where you will log in with your Penn key, which is the first part of your email, your UPenn email, and your password. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't have a Penn key, which is, again, a Penn email and the thing right before the at sign, you put that part in, that's called your Penn key, you'll make up a password, and then anything you're registered for will show up on your Blackboard site. And your Blackboard site will have the syllabus, which you're holding in your hand, and all of the readings, minus two, which I'll talk to you about in a minute. So anything that can be photocopied, we have already gotten copyright protection and photocopied for you on Blackboard. And all the readings are there, and they're already uploaded for the entire semester. And announcements will go through Blackboard, and emails, and once we have the paper assignment, everything will be up on this site. And if you have any trouble at all accessing Blackboard, then the contact person for you is my assistant, Robin Hartley, and you can see that she's available here at MBE Paper. She's also available at, they probably have her Hartley number. Her name is Robin Hartley, and you can reach her that way by just going to Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy website and clicking on her. But MBE Paper will always get to her, so if you're having any trouble understanding what I'm talking about here to access the readings, you can talk to Robin and she'll help you. Okay, now some of you will say, I don't want to read things up, because I don't have a Kindle or whatever, so I don't want to read material electronically. I want to have an honest-to-God kill-a-tree and have it here and then recycle it article. And yet I don't have a printer. That may be what you're thinking. So the good news is, down this hall, there is a student lounge. It looks like a big fishbowl and it has couches in it. And if you go into that couchy area, there are two student computers and a printer. So you can just go ahead and print the week's reading if you don't have access to a printer and you like to print. And while you're there, grab yourself some coffee because there's a kitchen and it has a Keurig, and all students who take classes with us are welcome to coffee, tea, and cocoa and water, so help yourself. Questions on any of that? Blackboard, readings, coffee, printers. Yes?
How much is the printing?
The price of the class, which, depending on where you are as a student, could be anywhere from $50,000 to $5,000, depending on whether you're a med student, a law student. After you've paid for the tuition, we don't make you pay for anything else. Yes, so for the $50,000 you're paying as a med student, you get the printing for free. It's a great, great bargain. And the coffee's free, too. It's all good.
It's not free in our lounge, the printing.
In the med student lounge, after they make you pay the $50,000, they make you pay for the printing. That's why you tell your friends to come take Introduction to Clinical Bioethics, where they can at least get some free printing. Okay, yes, all the printing is free. The coffee, the tea are all free. And actually, use of the bathrooms is free, too, because it's just like all-inclusive. So right back there, if you see right next to those folks in the corner, do you see a big ring? That's so you don't pocket it. Those are the bathroom keys. And if you walk down this hall and instead of going left into the free coffee printing area, you go right, that's where the bathrooms are. Bring the key back. Okay. Let's talk about using the bathroom while we're in class. Just go in and out. Just leave when you need to leave and come when you want to come and come late or don't come or listen to the recordings or whatever. Class is very flexible. Part of the reason that I want to urge you to understand this is a very flexible class is because I don't actually give you any bathroom breaks. I don't pause halfway through and hit the button and then say, all right, everybody disperse for 15 minutes and chat and whatever, and we'll get back together. I run the class straight through, 4:30, 6:30. I am so punctual, which doesn't mean you have to be, but I will get you out of here at 6:30 on the dot so you can have dinner. But that means whenever you need to leave for coffee or tea or printing or talk to your friends or whatever, just go ahead and do it. Okay? And I seriously do not mind. And I think we've got the chairs organized so that you can actually get in and out fairly easily. So hopefully. Questions on any of that? No? Alrighty. Good. Already talked about coming late, don't worry about it. You can't come at all, don't worry about it. If you are going to be absent, don't tell me. Just listen to the recording. And the recording, as I said, will be on the section of Blackboard that has the title Recordings, helpfully. And the class runs Tuesday or Thursday. Again, you mix and match as you wish. And the recordings will be up usually the next day. So it doesn't take long. Questions on any of that. Also, though I, as if you were here at the very beginning, sometimes you can see that I'm not so good at the little gadget and I make mistakes with the gadget, but I get two tries every week to actually get the thing recorded. So if I botch it or I have just a horrific day, I've got another session to get it right. So it's all good. Questions on any of that? Okay, good. Let's walk through some of the syllabus. Let's start at the top. The best way to reach me is email, and even my phone number goes to email. So it's email or email. And I have a very quick response time, so when you need me, you will be able to find me. I don't do office hours because folks who take graduate classes almost always have something else to do at the very time when the faculty member schedules an office hour. So there's just no point. When you need to see me, you're just going to email me directly, with the exception of one critical time in the semester. And that's when it's time for us to do the outlines, which I haven't talked to you about, and I will. At that time, which is around, they come to me around the 25th of October. Right after that, when I start giving the outlines back, many, many people will want to see me, far more people than I can handle the email volume for. And at that point, Robin Hartley, my assistant, will take over the scheduling for folks so that everybody can get in a very efficient way that works for your schedule. She'll have big blocks of time from me, and she'll help you find a good time to meet with me if you want to meet with me to talk about the assignment. So except for that, that's about a two-week block. All other times you just email me directly, just that strange window where we're talking, we could be talking as many as 115 people trying to get in. Everyone will get in, that's a guarantee for you, but during that block, you're going to want to talk to Robin, and you'll know it. Until you hear me say you're going to go through Robin, you just email me directly whenever you need me. Okay, it'll be very clear when we get to that point in the semester. So that's why there's no office hours, but you've got all my contact information, and as I said, I am a 24/7 emailer. It is ridiculous. I mean, last night I went to bed at 9:30, but I checked email at midnight and 2:30. So believe me, when people say 24/7, I live the talk. It is a sin. All right, so you'll be able to find me. Let's talk about the readings. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's talk about the readings that are not on Blackboard. There are two books that I would like you to buy. The first book is a classic, is the classic. If there's one text in bioethics that everyone ought to have, that text is The Principles of Biomedical Ethics. And it was written, is written by Tom Beauchamp, and it's not Beauchamp. So if you're at the cocktail party and you want to look like you're in the know, you're going to say Beauchamp, not Beauchamp. Gives you away right away as an amateur. And it's written by his co-author, Jim Childress, who is currently at UVA, and Beauchamp is at Georgetown. The two of them together, and if you ever come to the second semester of this class, it has a companion, 601, and is paired with a class called 602, which is unsexily called Conceptual Foundations, but it's actually a really great class. It's a class that is my absolute favorite, though I love this one too, and is often students' favorite as well. And Art Kaplan went on record once saying that it sounds like the Bataan Death March. But I got to tell you, it's actually a really fun class where you learn about how arguments are really built in bioethics from various camps in bioethics. At any rate, at the end of that semester, I talk about what I think is fundamentally wrong with the approach that Beauchamp and Childress created, which is nicknamed the Georgetown Mantra. And if you have ever heard of four moral principles talked about in a series, autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, even if you didn't know what that foursome is, that's the Georgetown Mantra, and those two people created it, and they created it in 1979. And actually, as a matter of fact, it was created in the Belmont Report, which Tom Beauchamp was the research associate on, and he took those three from the Belmont Report and made it into a book that was now called the Georgetown Mantra. That's a little bit of history you can get in the research ethics class in the spring. At any rate, they got the credit for it. They keep doing new editions, and the reason that I ask you to buy the book is twofold. First of all, I use it all year round. Only once each time, though, I'm already admitting to you. But also, it is a classic to be on the shelf. And I think in terms of some of the important concepts of bioethics, like informed consent or confidentiality, it's still the best synopsis of the concept out there. So those are the reasons I ask you to buy it. New, it is fairly expensive. I think it runs $35, $40 new. but there are a gazillion editions. I think they're in the sixth edition right now, and I don't care what edition you buy, because I will give you a page translator. Because the strategy of this book is to have a theoretical section, let's say, on informed consent, and then 10 pages of discussion of literature of late that is talking about informed consent. That's what is new every time they do the edition, that literature about informed consent. But I don't actually have us read those sections. I only have us read the classic explanation of the concept, and it's the same in every edition going all the way back to the first. So I'll give a page translator. So if you've got the third edition or the fifth edition or the second or the sixth, doesn't make any difference. We'll give you the pagination so you know exactly what pages to read. And that makes buying this book actually very inexpensive. Just go to an online bookstore, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever, and you're going to be able to find the book very inexpensively. And the only thing you're going to miss is the literature that keeps changing, because, of course, as in medicine, bioethics literature, not the kind of stuff I'm doing in this class, but the kind of stuff that bioethicists typically are publishing, doesn't have a long shelf life, and it's that that's changing every time they do a new volume. So it's nice to have one of the updated volumes, but it's not necessary. So I want you to buy that book. Though, if it's a hardship, after the $50,000 you're paying for the other degree that you're in, let me know and we can try to figure out how to photocopy it for you. It's not that long. The second book I'd like you to read is a book by Paul Monet called Borrowed Time, and it's a novel, and it's very inexpensive, very inexpensive. The reason I want you to buy this book, and I want you to get started reading it whenever you feel it's a novel. It's actually a biography, not a novel. But it's the story. Paul Monet is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He was a screenwriter as well in Hollywood. And this is the story of his partner, Roger, struggle with AIDS in the height of the AIDS epidemic pre-cocktail, before there was any HART, any ART, any... what is the name of the first drug that was out there? AZT. Right, this is prior to AZT. And the reason I want you to read it is because I think it's one of the most effective depictions of suffering from the patient's perspective. And we're going to have a session where we talk about suffering and the meaning of suffering from the various perspectives. And I think this book does a beautiful job of illustrating the worldview from the... It's a caretaker's perspective, but very much trying to give the insider view. And yes, it was AIDS in America at a very particular time, but the struggle with life-threatening illness, I think, is very well depicted, and it is it's a book hard to put down, heart-wrenching, yes, because Roger dies, and in the end, not the end of this book, there's a second book that Paul Monet writes after this one called Half a Life. It's the one that won the Pulitzer, but Paul Monet did die in 1994. His partner died, I think, in 1986. Roger died in 1986. Paul Monet died as well from AIDS, and he had AIDS at the time. He was HIV positive at the time when his partner was dying. It's a beautiful book, and it is very inexpensive. So those are the two books that I would like you to buy. I know some people in the class have actually already read it because they saw that it was on the syllabus and started reading it. You can't put it down. So any questions about those two books? No? Okay. All righty. You know where the class is because we're in it. So there you go. I'm going to talk about the requirements and give you a little bit of a lengthy explanation about them now, because I think it's really important, especially for those of you shopping, to understand what you're getting into. And so I want you to know what the game plan is. But what will ultimately happen is that you will do one assignment in two parts, and they're both pretty short in terms of pages. And they will both get handed into me either... Maybe you're going to actually do this kind of thing, print, staple, all good. I can accept papers like this. Or you'll probably do it the way most people do it, which is to send an electronic version. That electronic version needs to go to Robin Hartley because it is surprisingly time-consuming to print and staple and document and give a return receipt for 100 people in a class. It sounds like it would be a really simple task, but it's not, and I don't have good wrists. So I have Robin collating all of those papers. And that's actually a good thing, too, because she keeps track of when those assignments come in. So again, there'll be two. There'll be one around the end of October, and then there'll be one in December. And they are related, and I'm going to talk about those in a second. But send them to Robin unless you hand them to me. and that's the address MBE paper. Any questions so far? Okay, either I'm super clear or you're all asleep. It's all good. All right, let's talk about the two requirements. Anyone who's going to do any substantial work in bioethics has to understand how to make an argument. Has to understand how to make an argument in a way that is persuasive and respectful of the person you're trying to persuade. And this is actually very different from the way that some of you who are in the argument business, like law students or lawyers, make arguments in your daily life. Like how? Let's think about lawyers in litigation. They don't actually care if the opponent ends up friends. And they don't care if they persuade the opponent. They're only rhetorically trying to persuade the jury or the judges. And so they have a very different bar when it comes to how do you talk to your opponent. So lawyers in litigation are often scathing about the opponent. But in bioethics, you're actually trying to persuade people who are your professional colleagues. And if you haven't persuaded them, if you've only talked to the converted, let's say, those who are converted to your own view, and that's who you hobnob with, and that's all you want to make an impact on, you can just talk to yourself, but you're not making any change in the world. To make change in the world, you have to get the person who's on the other side of the table to not only think that your position is worth thinking about, but to think that you did it in a way that leaves them dignity and self-respect at the end of it. So it's actually quite a skill set to not only be able to make a powerful argument to be able to rebut and refute the opponent's argument, and everybody ends up friends, and you have a hope of actually changing the world in the direction you think your argument is directing you towards. That is the skill I'm going to teach you this semester. And I want you to be able to make a very compelling argument to people that you would want to stay friends with, to be able to get across what you want to get across and make the impact in the world that you want to make. That's my goal. And I'm going to do that with a very small exercise. So I have a very lofty goal, and I have a very small exercise to do it with. And this is what I'm going to do. And I've done this year after year, and I have a lot of success with it. So while it looks a little pedantic sometimes from the outside, I'd like you to just stay open-minded that as a method, this really does help you become a stronger arguer and write better papers. Now, when you ultimately leave this class, and maybe you hope that sooner rather than later, you will make big arguments. You will make 15-page arguments and 25-page arguments, and if you're a lawyer, you will make 80-page arguments, and that's fabulous. But the thing about arguments, and if you're philosophically trained, you know that this is true, is that it is the same rigor in doing a 4-page argument as it is doing an 80-page argument. It's just where you're expanding the argument that makes the difference. But argumentatively, structurally, there's really no difference. That's why, for example, if you end up in the Master of Bioethics program, for your final project, the final thesis that you do to get out of here, you could do a piece that is only 1,200 words and actually graduate, because commentary arguments in the New England Journal, in JAMA, in Lancet, they're all between 900 and 1,500 words. And you've got to get in, you've got to be tight, you've got to be persuasive, make your case, get out, and have changed the world. So it isn't how many words, it's what are you doing with the words. So if I teach you a technique where you can make a really compelling 1,200-word paper, I'm teaching you a technique that you can write a 20-page or 30-page or an 80-page. But I don't want to read 80 pages of folks who are trying to learn how to make an argument, and you understand. I need it to be small so it can be rigorous and it can be highly examined so that we can take it apart and understand all of what's going right in it and what's going wrong. And to do that, the exercise is very constrained. It's not only constrained, it's almost pedantic is a nice word, but it's almost an exercise. So all the great papers you want to write in bioethics, all the arguments that you see, all the clinical ethics problems you want to address, you will, but not in this class. In this class, you're going to do an argument about physician-assisted suicide, and you're going to do it in a way that is very regimented and highly structured and rigid. And that's because all you're doing in this class is learning a technique that you're going to employ in all other aspects, even if you don't go on to another bioethics class. Knowing how to make a persuasive argument is the kind of writing that you can use in any field at all. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to give me a 2-page outline. That's the midterm, 2-page outline. Not going to be graded. It's just going to be ruthlessly, you know, constructively commented on. I think your opponent's going to be offended here. Here's an argument that I think has an easy rebuttal and you think it's strong. Here's an argument I think that's really compelling, but I wonder if you could add this to it. That's what you're going to get back from this 2-page outline. And if at the end you get this thing at the bottom that says, good to go, you're ready to just write it up for the final. If you get something that says, this could use some tweaking, then I would suggest you actually redo it. You do a second midterm. Again, not graded, but you just get it right. And I'm going to tell you why I want you to do that. If you get a, if we better talk, that's probably because you're from a discipline where you're not used to making arguments. That's not what people do in the world you're in. There's a lot of places in medicine. For example, you're not an academic nurse or an academic clinician. Doctors and nurses don't tend to make philosophical arguments. It's just a different kind of genre. So you may be very well published in empirical clinical work, for example, but not how to actually make a philosophical argument. So sometimes you'll get this, maybe we should talk, and then I'll help you, and I'll work with you on what's going wrong here and what's the strategies that you need to employ to tighten up that skill set. At any rate, you'll decide how much you want to put into this, but my advice is you work on it until you get a good to go. Because here's the thing that you don't probably know unless you're a philosopher. Once you have an outline, you are only a few hours from a completed paper. And that is the truth. A 2-page outline that says good to go is a 2-hour exercise to getting the final done and getting an A. And that's the truth. An outline, tight, to turn into a 4-to-6-page paper is just sitting there and banging out the prose around the outline. Now, why not let you do prose to start out with? Because prose masks... what is the polite word for BS? Prose masks arguments that are not tight. Prose uses rhetorical flourish to pull the wool over people's eyes, to bring them along, to not be able to show the bare bones and show your true cards. Prose is very helpful at that, and that's why people use rhetorical flourishes when they do speech writing rather than, you know, tight argumentation. So I need to see the bare bones argument to see how good it is. Putting the prose to it is a very simple matter. Everybody can do that. It's the tight argument that matters. How can I prove to you that this is true? If you reach back to undergrad, or maybe you have to go back to high school or someplace, where you read a philosophical argument, like some piece from Plato, the thing that's so hard about being a student in a philosophy class is that every argument sounds good. I mean, you read one argument and you are absolutely a libertarian, and then you read another one and you are utilitarian. You read another one and you're a deontologist, and you're swinging around like this all the time. And that's what philosophy feels like at the sophomore level, because you're reading prose. And the prose, you can't actually pick apart the arguments. So I'm not going to just ask you to do this outline de novo. I'm going to work all semester working through arguments that people are giving in the real world, in the philosophical world, helping you learn the skill of picking apart where are you getting snowed. Where is the sleight of hand? Where's the argument that doesn't really hold, but they did a rhetorical flourish and copied right over it? I'm going to make you savvy critics, and making you a savvy critic is going to make you a savvy writer and a savvy thinker. So you're going to do this outline, going to work on it, get it right, and then you're going to ultimately just dash it out. There's nothing between the outline and that final. That is no effort at all. Put all of the effort into the outline. I'm not kidding you. It's a couple of hours at the computer banging it out, just building the prose around the sentences. It's that simple. Questions about any of that? I'm going to give a whole session on how we do this after we've got a little bit under our belt.
Are we going to revise the paper at all, or is that the final?
Nope, and you're not going to need to, because if you grab a syllabus, because if you want to do well on the paper, you're just going to get the outline to the point where it says good to go, because good to go means you're going to get an A. You can't fail. You can't, first of all, you can't fail, because we've got great inflation, not the yin-yang. But you can't fail to get an A when you've got a comment on an outline that says good to go. It's not possible. You can't botch an excellent argument by bad prose. You just don't have it in you. Prose is just the thing that carries people along. Now, that's a pretty radical view, and if you're an English literature major, you're probably suffocating, and I'm very sorry for it, because there are disciplines in the world that believe that language is really very, the type of language and the eloquence of the language is the thing in itself. But that's not what philosophers or bioethicists think. They think the guts is all that matters, and the guts is the argument. And once the argument is good, you're not going to need to revise the paper. Spend your time revising the outline, and then put 2 hours into putting it into prose. Questions? Yeah.
In the back of my mind, I kind of have a fear in expressing my own knowledge on the paper, because you know all the principles and theories that you can compare.
Yes,
but
how are you going to succeed? Yeah, no, it's good. This is such a rigged argument that I'm not going to let you use any theories, and I'm not going to let you use any background. This is going to be an argument about pure consequences. There's no reason to hide what it's going to be. I'm going to ask you to do a pro-con analysis of whether we should legalize or not legalize physician-assisted suicide, and I'm not going to let you use any theories. I'm going to ask you to argue, will we be better off or worse off? Will people be happier? Will they be hurt? Will they benefit? And if not, and they won't benefit, in what ways will they be harmed? And we're going to do 3 weeks, the next 3 weeks, on physician-assisted suicide and the consequences. So, and then we're going to have a two-hour session on, all right, let's talk about what the pros and the cons are. And everybody's going to throw pros and cons into the discussion. And you're going to have a whole bucket of pros and cons to pick from. And then you are going to weigh and balance them. It's not going to be any mystery. I don't want anything original, because this is just an exercise. So you're not going to have to worry that you don't know anything original. We're all going to work together. And this is, by the way, an open note, open friend, open, you know, internet kind of exercise. Because here's the thing. To refute somebody's argument, to challenge somebody's argument, you can't make this crap up. You got to know how to do it, and I'm going to teach you how to do it. But I'm not going to ask you to pull out any theories or principles. It's going to be a very constrained bucket of pros and cons.
But your argument can be influenced by what you have read. Let's say to make a paper, let's say I browsed around some philosophical books, I could have an influence in the way to form my own idea.
And that's fair game. But what I want to assure you today is that if you work hard on the outline, you're going to do great in the class. The only way that you won't do spectacularly well in the class is if you're like, look, I'm going to do one outline, and if she likes it, she likes it, and if she doesn't, she doesn't, and that's it. Anybody who wants to work on the outline, I gave 95% A's, A or A minus, and a couple of B pluses, and maybe a couple of people were like, screw it, I don't care, I'm just writing down, I don't care, that it doesn't matter, B's. I mean, it is very hard to warrant your anxiety. It just, grad school's not like that. It's not like med school or law school or nursing school. It's just not like that. My goal is to get across to you, how do you do this task, and I will do anything it takes, and as long as you're willing to work at it, you will absolutely get an A in this class. That's the end of the story. There's just nothing to worry about. And when I get 3 weeks from now, when I introduce this, you will have no worries at all. Nope, it's not going to be a worry. Just take it right off your plate. I know right now it's all in the abstract. It won't be. It won't be. It's a very simple exercise, as long as you just, you know, work at what needs to be done. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about handing it in. Because here's another thing that's very odd about this class, and I think in a good way, though sometimes people find this feature, they think it sounds really good, but when it gets down to the moment of truth, they sometimes don't hold up their end of the bargain. So I'm going to tell you a funny story. I don't care when you hand it in. It says you have to hand it in on October 25th. And you do if you want to get it back in a timely fashion. If you want to get it back 2 weeks from October 25th, you have to hand it in October 25th at 3 o'clock. Because we're going to run out of time. by the time I've graded 100 to 120, I know it doesn't look like this class is that large, but it's already well into the 80s right now, and we still have a big shopping period left. By the time last year it had 120 people in it, by the time I've gotten through all these outlines and I've carefully looked through them, it's time for you to write the final, you know, by the time I've met with everybody. So if you don't have it in on the 25th at 3 o'clock, you're going to get put into a folder that says to be graded. And the to be graded folder won't get opened up again until after finals. Does that matter? It does not, in terms of any grade that you'll get from me. So here's the thing, and I'm going to say it really clearly. If you get the paper in on October 25th, you'll get it back in a timely fashion, and then if you hand it in by Friday, December 14th at noon, you will have a grade the first week of January, and your life will go on, and I think we'll all just live and prosper. If you don't get the paper in on October 25th, there will be no penalty, ever. People carry incompletes in this class literally for years. 7, 6, 4 years. There's a syllabus right here, Bill. Years people carry incompletes, and once they've done the work, they just get the grade. Just gets erased, and they get the grade. Now, there are some constraints. If you're a medical student, you actually have to have the class done by the time you graduate 4 years from now, or however more years you've got, because Helene Weinberg at the medical school will not let you out. She will not let you out. Same thing if you're a JD. You got a three-year program, you got to get it done. That's not my rule. That's theirs. Besides that, I absolutely do not care. But here's the thing. A lot of people, and you get me doing the grading. Most classes that are this large have a TA, and you got some TA doing the grading. You got me. You got me, and I got a lot of experience, and I can do a lot of good for you in this skill set. But I already have blocked off the number of hours it's going to take between October 25th and November, whatever it is, to get all those things graded. If you miss the window, you go into the to-be-graded pile. And then I get to it after the people who handed in on time. It's not a punishment. It's just coping. It's just enabling the people that got it in when they could get in. Is it pejorative? It is not. You can hand it in whenever you want. And lots of people hand it in very late. But here's the thing. You got to do the outline, and you got to get comments back, and then you can do the final. You can't just go right for the final. Because that's not me teaching you. This is a class that has a stunningly low number of pages for a full credit, you know, class. 4 to 6 pages is your total assignment. So you got to do it in the sequence. So that means that, for example, when you got it in on November 1st, and I don't have it back to you, are you going to call me and email me and berate me for how you don't have the paper back? No. Right. That's the thing. So if you want it back in a timely fashion and hold me accountable, then you got to get it in on time. So I actually had this, I had a student who, she was 3 years late with the paper, and she wanted to graduate on, like, let's say, May 11th. So she hands it to me on May 8th, and she wants me to grade it between the 8th and 11th. I didn't have time. So she gets her dad involved, and the dad calls, and they're yelling. It's a three-year late paper, and everybody's upset. Finally, I'm like, okay, let's path of least resistance it. Let's just go ahead and see if we can get this thing graded. It had been so long. This wasn't the fall class. It's the spring class. There's two assignments. It had been so long, she forgot that there was actually a second assignment. She had only handed me the first. Anyway, she didn't get to graduate, because even if I had graded it, which I would have, she didn't have the final done. She only had the midterm. That story is only to convey to you that incompletes don't matter. You can carry them as long as you want, but you're going to have a delay in grading, and you're not going to be able to complain. Right? Okay. But it doesn't matter if you get an incomplete. In fact, for those of you who are in other very demanding programs where you're going to have tests and other exams and other paper requirements, I practically encourage you to take your time and take the stress off yourself and just say, you know what, I'm probably just going to get an incomplete. I'm going to hand the outline in sometime this semester. I'll get it back right around final time, and I'll use, you know, that holiday break to finish the paper, and I will not have to stress about my other classes. It actually can be a great advantage to you. So, again, there's no punishment involved in getting an incomplete. I'll erase it the minute the stuff gets in and I have it graded, so it's not a worry. But the deadlines are hard and fast in terms of timely return. Questions? Objections? refutations? Dropping of the class? It's all good. All right, let's look quickly here at the syllabus, and then I want to get on. Of course, I would have forgotten my watch, and the clock's behind that thing, so somebody give me the time.
5:15.
I've got plenty of time. Good. All righty. So here's our game plan. Tonight, I'm going to talk about withdrawal cases, legal cases at the end of life. Then we're going to do 3 sessions on physician-assisted suicide in preparation for the paper. Mostly, this is going to be theoretical stuff. And you're not going to be asked to do anything theoretical on the paper, but it's going to help you know what your paper is not about. It will be the paper that is not what you're writing. So we're going to look at classic arguments in physician-assisted suicide, and we will ask you to get started on that Monette book. Then I'm going to do an entire session on how to make an argument. I'm going to teach you the skill set that I think you need to go out and use this class for whatever other kind of writing, persuasive argument that you would like to make. Then we'll talk about the, and when I say paper assigned on the 9th and the 11th, once I've given it out on the 9th, I'll post it to both sections of Blackboard, because I never know who's actually taking it on a Thursday and who's actually taking it on a Tuesday. You'll see that all the deadlines are like clustered, except that one for the outline due date. So when I say paper assigned between the 9th and the 11th, you'll have it on the 9th. If you don't come to class till the 11th, you won't get the explanation till the 11th, but it'll be out on the 11th. Okay. Then I will talk about the experience of illness, because I think that a lot of times bioethics talks about ethical issues but misses the first person, what is it like to be ill, and what is suffering that actually generates all kinds of ethical obligations, but also ethical landmines, the kind of problems that come to an ethics committee or to an ethics consultant service. And that's when we're going to talk about that book, Borrowed Time, but also this very beautiful piece that was in the New England Journal called The Nature of Suffering and the Goals of Medicine by a physician named Eric Castle. So we will also talk about a physician perspective looking at suffering as well as a caretaker perspective on that day. All right, then we have a week off because there is a fall break, and then there's the National Bioethics Conference. There won't be a soul here. Everything is in Washington. I urge you to come. It's an interesting conference, and it's not usually nearby, and it is nearby this time, and Penn has a very prominent role in the national conference, for one thing, because it's the top flight bioethics institution nationally. Many of us are on the program, but also Penn has an evening reception, and the master's program has a huge booth. So at any rate, perhaps you'll be able to join us at some point. Then we're going to talk about professional ethics, and that will be in late October. Then we're going to look at 2 key concepts that you can't be without classically to understand bioethics: confidentiality and informed consent. And then we're going to look at reproductive ethics by looking at abortion, a classic argument in abortion. And finally, we're going to end up with an argument about mediation and versus clinical ethics consultation. Again, let me remind you of what is the strategy of this class. It's to introduce you to the way that arguments are built so that no matter what you read from hereafter, you're going to understand how to read critically and how to be able to protect your own positions when you're trying to defend them against someone who disagrees. So it really is a class that's very skill-based, and we're going to use classical, canonical pieces in bioethics to do it. Questions? Thoughts?
All right, are you sure? We got a couple more minutes while I load this baby up and get the lights down.
They've had enough.
Okay, now, will I put it in the dark? Yeah, all right, hang on.
All right, here we go. So, depending on how you look at the legal history in the United States, you may pick different cases as those that are most pressing in their implications for clinical ethics. I'm going to tell you the array that is often thought to be the most important set, and there they are. Quinlan, we're going to talk about at length today. Bouvet, again, if you want to be in the know for the cocktail party, Bouvet, not Bouvia. Cruzan, that's the sine qua non. That's perhaps the biggest case of all. Washington versus Glucksberg, Vacco versus Quill, then Wendlin versus Wendlin, and the Gonzales case. What I have here are the end of life withdrawal of care cases, and that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Quinlan, Bouvet, Cruzan, and then this very interesting Wendlin. Yes?
Is this going to be on Blackboard?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Everything will be on Blackboard. Yep. Absolutely. So you don't have to be scrambling if you just need the PowerPoints. Absolutely. I'll get those up. Robin will get those up tonight. And these are the physician-assisted suicide cases, these two that went before the Supreme Court. They went before the Supreme Court at the very same time. I'll explain one of them next week and one of them the week after. And then 2 weeks from now, I'll talk to you about the Gonzales case. But Gonzales was the attorney general under Bush, in the Bush administration. And Gonzales is the case where the Bush administration tries to make unconstitutional the Oregon law, the Death with Dignity Act, that enables folks to have access to physician-assisted suicide in Oregon. Right now, you can have physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, Washington, Montana, and maybe Vermont. Somebody can check that. But at the time of Vacco and Glucksberg, it was only in Oregon and up to 2006. These are very recent. This is 2008, these extra two states. But the Gonzales case was the Bush administration's attempt to get the Oregon law considered unconstitutional, and it actually failed. Even though he had a very conservative Supreme Court, the Supreme Court protected the Oregonians' right to have the Death with Dignity Act. But that we will be talking, these three cases we're going to be talking about in the next 2 weeks, not tonight. So tonight I'm going to be talking about the set that is about withdrawal of care. And you'll see how nicely that will lead us into the questions of physician-assisted suicide. So at any point you want to stop me, please do. I'm always happy to be interrupted. So anytime you have a question, just shoot your hand up. And there are people in this room, it's a very interdisciplinary group in this course, and there are people in this room who have far more expertise than I do in legal cases, because your lawyers are law students. So if you hear me as a philosopher taking any misstep, let me urge you to just shoot your hand right up and get me back on track. So do not hesitate. One of the things that is so fabulous about taking classes in this department is how diverse and how much expertise we actually have collated here into one room. And that means we need to make use of that expertise. And that goes for any discipline that you're coming from: social work, nursing, medicine, law. When you hear something that doesn't seem like it's consistent with the discipline you're from and your fact base, dental medicine, social work, whatever it is, clergy, you just make sure that you get that voice right in there so that we have a really informed discussion. All right, I'm going to start us off with Quinlan. Who wants to sacrifice their watch for the cause? Does anyone wear a watch anymore?
Yeah, I have one.
You do?
Yeah.
And you're not leaving like your friends?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I do not care. I'm that's just a joke. I'm just very quirky. Okay, very good. I've got plenty of time, and this will be a nice watch in case you decide to leave it here. So that's all good, too. All right. Very good. I think I could definitely use a red watch. Okay. I am setting this up so I can see it. And here we go. All right. You've all heard about Quinlan. It was 1975. It was a very different era, and you're going to see how very distinct this era is, because some of the things that are going to be said in this case are going to strike you immediately as hopelessly out of date. But it kicked off patient-centered decision-making about withdrawal of life support. No doubt about it. Quinlan is the big kickoff for the modern bioethical era of patient-centered medicine. That is going to be Autumn's claim. Here is the fact pattern. On April 15th in 1975, Karen Ann Quinlan was 21 years old, and she stopped breathing for 2 15-minute periods. People don't know why. Maybe it's because there were those fad diets in the 70s where you were trying to eat 600 calories or whatever. Maybe she mixed it with alcohol. Who knows? But it meant that she got into a persistent vegetative state, so she had no higher cognitive function whatsoever. In fact, she not only needed 24-hour care, she was on a respirator. She had to have a feeding tube, of course, antibiotics, catheter, the whole thing. Her whole body support system had to be kept by artificial means. So this is, importantly, for the history of the end of legal life legal cases, a ventilator case. The first case was ventilator. It's a Catholic family. The Quinlans are a Catholic family. But this is before the Catholic Church started getting involved in withdrawal of care. You probably now know that in the Schiavo debate, the Pope spoke, came down and said, taking away nutrition and hydration, this is a ventilator, was not consistent with Catholic theology. But at the time, this is a ventilator case anyway, but at the time, the Catholic Church wasn't so involved in social issues the way that the Church became, especially in the late 70s and coming into the Reagan era in the early 80s, where abortion became a single issue. So the Quinlan family was actually supported by their local parish priest. And what they had seen was that after several years, she was not going to recover. PV estate, they wanted her ventilator removed. So it was her family that was leading the charge here. This is a New Jersey case, and this is going to be very important and more meaningful for the JDs in the room than others perhaps. But the way that courts work in the United States, the jurisdiction, it depends on whether it's a state case or a federal case. But if it's a state case and it's decided ultimately in a state, only that state has to abide by what is done, though other states look around. But it only has jurisdiction and speaks to the particular state that it's in, unless it kicks up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will hear state-based cases and federal-based cases. This case, Quinlan, stayed in the Supreme Court of New Jersey. So when I tell you the end of the story, I want you to note to yourself, it's only in the state of New Jersey that it was applicable, but it had far-ranging consequences. So it goes to the trial court, and the trial court says no, she cannot, you, Mr. Quinlan, cannot have her ventilator withdrawn. So it gets kicked up to the New Jersey Supreme Court. Now this is interesting. Whenever you're going to make one of these constitutional kind of cases, you're going to have to pick what your tool is. And so the Quinlan lawyer decided to pick two arguments. First Amendment as a weapon, and Eighth Amendment as a weapon. On the First Amendment, Quinlan argued, as a Catholic, this prolonging of her dying process, that is, her being prevented from dying and coming to eternal life, is inconsistent with my religious belief, and you are imposing your state's understanding of what it means to have life versus death on my religious view. That was the Quinlan argument on the First Amendment. The second argument was an Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. They said to be saddled with this torture of being on a ventilator like that violates the Eighth Amendment's requirement to avoid cruel and unusual punishment. Those were the two amendments that the Quinlan lawyers picked, having never seen, you know, any of big end of life cases. They picked the first and the eighth. At the end of the day, do you know what? And from there on, what amendment do you think actually ultimately carries the argument? You know what number is the big one? 14. 14 is going to be the absolute powerful argument, and what's going to be interesting is this. The court says the First Amendment argument is dumb. The court actually is going to side ultimately with Quinlan. But they say your First Amendment argument is really dumb. And the reason is because the state sometimes has an interest so powerful in preserving life that it trumps your religious view. And this is what they actually say. For the sake of life, courts can sometimes order, I know this is out of date, blood transfusions for Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, those of you who are engaged in contemporary clinical care know that any time a competent Jehovah's Witness says, I do not want blood products, you don't go anywhere near them with blood products. If they are competent, of sound mind, if they say, I am a Jehovah's Witness, you absolutely will not get a court to put blood products in their body. That's because we are many years post-Quinlan, and you're going to see the evolution tonight in these legal cases. But the argument that the Quinlan court, the Supreme Court in the Quinlan case made was, the state
may have an interest so powerful in preserving your life that it trumps your religion. So the Quinlan argument that First Amendment is so powerful that it could argue for ventilator withdrawal fails. And then they say, your argument about the Eighth Amendment is really dumb because you can't take the cruel and unusual punishment statute and apply it to non-prisoners, to non-punishment. You can't metaphorically say, oh, it's just cruel and unusual punishment to have to live like this. That's a metaphor. That's about penal sanctions, says the Supreme Court, and we're not buying it. So how did the Quinlans win? Because the Supreme Court argued you do have a constitutional, notice the language, right to privacy. And that right to privacy permits you to refuse medical care, and I have it in italics, under certain circumstances. And I'm going to tell you the legal reasoning in the Quinlan case, because it's very prescribed. But let's talk for a minute about the right to privacy. This is right after Roe versus Wade, where the 14th Amendment had its big starring role in the Roe case, and we're also going to see Griswold in here too. But the interesting thing about Quinlan is it's framed entirely as a autonomous decision-making case. It's framed entirely as if Karen Ann Quinlan were speaking to us, when actually this is a surrogate decision-making case. The court did not make that distinction. They treated Joseph Quinlan and Karen Ann Quinlan as the exact same. That's not going to be true in cases after Quinlan. But this is talking about the right to refuse medical treatment as if Karen is the one making the request. They did not differentiate between somebody making a decision for a patient and a patient making a decision for herself. So it's not about surrogate decision making, interestingly. But the point here is that they argue that you have a right to privacy in certain circumstances, and that's the 14th Amendment, just as Eunice said. There are two precedents. I already told you Roe is one. Roe is actually the one most near in everybody's memory in 1975, because it's the 1973, and I don't need to tell you, abortion law that allows for elective abortion in the first trimester, and the argument was a woman's right to privacy in the 14th Amendment. But prior to that, just a few years before, was the Griswold case, and the Griswold case was the famous birth control case. The Griswolds were a Connecticut couple married who wanted to buy birth control to do family planning. And the state of Connecticut said, we do not allow you to buy family planning family planning stuff, pill, condoms, because the state has an interest in procreation. They sued, and the Supreme Court decided that indeed a married couple has the right to decide how large their family is going to be. But that's, and I'm pretty sure that's a 1967 case, but we're right around there, and we're not, what is it? Do you have a better date? Oh, no, okay, sorry. So I think it's the 1967 case, but at any rate, both of them hinged on the 14th Amendment, so the Supreme Court said, forget the first, forget the eighth, the big star here, the winning ticket, like I'm going to show you this semester, what is your winning argument, what's your winning hand? 14th. And the 14th Amendment is going to be the star throughout all that, all those cases that I talked about. 14th Amendment is going to be the star of every single one of them. We're never going to talk about another amendment. And I already told you what Griswold was. Here's Roe. You already know that. The line of reasoning says that the right to privacy is broad enough to include refusing medical treatment, but it's under certain circumstances. Because sometimes the state's interest in your life is bigger than what you want done with your life. This is 1975, not 2012. 1975, the state sometimes cares more about your life sometimes than you do, and in those circumstances, it can trump your right to privacy. But here's the legal reasoning. In the Quinlan case, the court said there is a sliding scale. If, and that's the approach that they used, if the bodily intrusion is high, if the prognosis is very low, then the state's interest is very low. But if the intrusion level is very low and the prognosis is very high, the state's interest is very high. So if you are in a persistent vegetative state and need everything done, and you will never get out of that because people don't get out of a PVS state, then the state does not have an interest in forcing you to stay alive if you don't want to. But if you only need blood products, 1975. That's all you need? A transfusion? That's just an IV, for heaven's sake. Low intrusion. And you will survive. The state will order you to have the blood transfusion. That's the New Jersey view of the sliding scale in 1975.
Couldn't be higher with Quinlan, couldn't be lower prognosis, no hope of change. Father could exercise her right to privacy, and that's how it was thought of. He can exercise for her the right to privacy. This is what the case actually said. We have no hesitancy in deciding that no external compelling interest of the state could compel Karen to endure the unendurable. And they partly did buy the torture, cruel and unusual deal. And here's their rationale. We glean that physicians can distinguish between curing the ill and comforting and easing the dying, that they refuse to treat the curable as if they were dying, and that they sometimes refuse to treat the hopeless and dying as if they were curable. We think these attitudes represent a balanced implementation of a profoundly realistic perspective on the meaning of life and death, and that they respect the whole Judeo-Christian tradition of regard for human life.
Another way that we see that this is dated, because 2012, they're not going to talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition in the United States.
1975, the Buddhists be damned, or the Muslims. At this point, the idea is this country is framed in this particular tradition, and withdrawal of life support is consistent with it. For those possibly curable, such devices, this is the advent of the ventilator. So the country is struggling with what do you do with ventilator technology when they've never actually had to think about once you get it started, how do you get it stopped? And that's often the case with technology, right? We bulldoze into it, and then we figure out, oh, there were a whole bunch of conundrums we didn't actually think through. And maybe we couldn't. Hindsight's always 20/20. For those possibly curable, such devices are of great value, and as ordinary medical procedures are essential. But in light of the situation in the present case, one would have to think that the use of the same respirator or life support could be considered ordinary in the context of the possibly curable patient, but extraordinary in the context of the forced sustaining of cardiorespiratory processes of an irreversibly doomed patient. It's not ordinary care, it's extraordinary care, and it can be stopped. So, go ahead.
What was the original physician's justification for saying, no, you can't?
Let's walk through this slide and you're going to get your answer. Perfect, right? She was planted here. I always plant these things. In the culture of medicine, power for decision making, and some of you who are nurses and doctors and nursing students and med students,
some of you may be able to reach back to this day, but most of you, it's so far from memory. But there was a time when medical decisions were in the hands of the providers and not in the hands of the patients.
In fact, there was a completely deferential attitude. Sometimes now there will be, like, hey,
nurse practitioner Tom or Dr. Sue, if this were your mom, there's still that. Like, give me advice. Absolutely. But if you think X and I think Y, I'm going to go with Y.
So we're in a very different cultural shift. But here's the trial court, and this speaks very much to this question she's just asked. The nature of care is the responsibility of a physician. This is what the trial court said. The determination of whether Quinlan be removed from the respirator is to be left to the treating physician. Patients and families should not decide. Treating physicians do. Why would the treating physicians want that?
Now, that is a radically important question that she has just asked, because it talks about a gestalt shift so spectacularly, 180 from where we are now, it's hard to get our head around it. Now, your typical dispute in an ICU is that the clinical staff says the situation is futile and we should stop aggressive treatment. In a dispute, many times people actually agree, but I'm talking about when you have a dispute. And the patient's family says, I want everything done. That's your typical classical clinical ethics dispute. Physicians say stop, or nursing staff says stop, and the patient's family says, I want to keep going. That's your classic debate today. In 1975, it was exactly the opposite. Physicians and nurses felt that to take ventilator support away was tantamount to murder. This distinction we're going to talk about in many classes over the course of the semester between act and omission, between allowing to die and killing, which is the big distinction that's getting played with for the next couple of weeks in physician-assisted suicide versus the withdrawal of care. is the reason why physicians were not comfortable, because they believed that by their own hand, then, breath was being removed, that a patient was being deprived of the very sustenance of life by the physician or nurse's hand. And that's why they didn't want it.
What?
I completely understand the opposite opinions of the physicians in 1970s and now, but what's the rationale behind the ordinary people's rationings change from the 1970s?
So what thing?
Like, as you said, like a family members now wants to continue their life.
Okay, so again, I don't want to overpaint that. Let me state just a little bit more cautiously how I frame that. I said if there's a dispute, it usually goes like this. The truth is, there's usually not a dispute. Most times, clinical staff and surrogates agree. Most times they agree. Many, many families do not want loved ones to have prolonged in situations that are considered terminal, end stage, no hope, futile. You know, these words are very fluid. But it is usually the case that families agree that it's time to back off on aggressive care, at least withhold, if not withdraw. Most of the time there's agreement. When there's disagreement, it's the group of people who believe that to withdraw care or to withhold care is not in God's will, that it puts too much burden on families to make life or death decisions, that it doesn't demonstrate doing everything one can for the loved one, that it doesn't allow space for a miracle. There's many different reasons why, or maybe a family doesn't feel confident that you actually have given outstanding care. Maybe two treating teams have said slightly different things about prognosis. There can be all kinds of reasons, and we can talk about those over the course of the semester. But it is not the standard moment in the ICU that there is a dispute at all. All I mean is that if there's a dispute, it tends to be physicians and nurses saying let's stop and families saying let's not, and it was the reverse when there was disputes. And what accounts for that is that whole array of values that I've just laid out, including I don't want that burden on me to make that decision for my loved ones. There's a whole lot of reasons. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about Quinlan is it starts the entire movement. Before 1975, there were no such things as advanced directives. In fact, it's the Quinlan case that kicks that off, and I'll tell you about that in a second. This case, and I remember this because I was a small child in 1975. It was in the aura. It was everywhere. The Quinlan case was talked about everywhere because Americans had never been confronted with the possibility of actually getting stuck on one of these machines. It had only been the promise of the technology, not the downside. Quinlan on the front page of the newspaper, that was all across the country, not just in New Jersey. Everyone was following that, as you'll see in a second. But everyone was worried about, do I want that to happen to me? And this was the beginning of the conversations of the dignified death, which, that many years later, 20 years later, leads to the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. And actually, the case that we'll talk about if you stay with me for the spring class, the famous Quill case. And remember I showed you that list of cases we're going to do? It was Quill versus Vacco. That's Timothy Quill, who's one of the pioneers in palliative care and was an early advocate for physician-assisted suicide. And is now not really holding the banner for that, for physician-assisted suicide, as much as good palliative care and even palliative sedation. But at any rate, that's the Quill. And he's got a case called Diane, a case of individualized decision-making in the New England Journal. And that's a case, again, that plays on the idea of the dignified death. This starts in 1975. Look at how this the introduction of advanced directives starts in 1975. The first one was formalized in California in 76. By 77, seven other states had followed. And then it was just a cascade. That's how fast conversations about getting prepared. Now, let's not get too rosy here. Most people go into American hospitals today without an advance directive, and even fewer have a healthcare proxy, which is the legal power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney. So, of course, you know, it's not like I want to paint the rosiest picture of how this achieved everything. All I want to do is say it achieved a broad cultural shift that patients had the right to make these decisions. Does everybody think ahead of maybe I'll be in a car accident? No, of course not. But it did create this gestalt shift in who gets to decide. Of course, again, this is a ruling that only applies to New Jersey, not binding in any other state, officially.
though a lot of trends. So what happened? Well, the physicians didn't just withdraw care.
So those of you who are clinically trained know that if you have any hope of someone being able to breathe on her own, you will have to go through a process of weaning to see if the body can take over the function of breathing. And they did not believe, the physicians at the bedside, did not believe that they should be bringing about her death by the withdrawal of the ventilator. If the courts insisted the ventilator be removed, they were going to do it through the process of weaning to give her the absolute maximal chance of breathing on her own.
6 weeks after the decision, she still was not able to be weaned. She was on the ventilator. Finally, they did withdraw her. She lived, actually, another 9 years in a fetal position. She did spontaneously breathe. The
early weaning didn't work. Ultimately, it did. When they withdrew it, she spontaneously breathed, and she breathed on her own for 9 years, curled up in the fetal position, receiving artificial hydration and nutrition. The parents never questioned artificial hydration and nutrition. It was never even on their radar. She lived in an institution for 9 years, and then she died of pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. Who's paying for that care?
Same people who pay now. People have insurance.
But if once you get to an institution, it's hard to, you know, they can't kick you out. You're on Medicaid or Medicare. But there's no doubt about it. In fact, Wednesday we've got a class called Rationing, and it is one of the central questions of the questions about economic rationing in healthcare dollars. What do you do when someone is not going to recover?
But at this point, I don't think, certainly it will not be an argument that any politician can make to say, yep, we should withdraw care unilaterally on people to save money. Not that the economists aren't thinking that thought. Yeah. Okay, let's move to the 1986 case, Bouvet. Again, not Bouvier, Bouvet. This is a California case, and it is a state case, so once again, it only applies to California. Here's the case. Elizabeth Bouvet was born with cerebral palsy. By 28, she was quadriplegic. She had degenerative arthritis. She had chronic pain. When she ate, she had nausea and vomiting. She had even been married. She had gone to college, but her husband had left her and she was alone and she was in an institution because no one could afford to take care of her, of her friendship circle or family. She was mentally competent. This is going to be very critical in this case because we are not now talking about a surrogate case at all. We're actually talking about Bouvet, Elizabeth Bouvet, who's got just as much cognitive functioning as you and I. And she's making this decision, what she wants to have happen. She's saying it very directly to the clinical team. She's trying to starve herself so that she can die. She wants to be allowed to die. So she stops eating, but she's in an institution. And so she's quadriplegic. So they decide, nope, she is not going to die. She's not going to starve herself. We're going to put a feeding tube in, yes, against her will, but what's she going to do about it? She's quadriplegic, and we're going to feed her and give her hydration. And so she generates a lawsuit. The trial court says, no way is she having that feeding tube removed. No way. And it gets kicked up to the Court of Appeals. The trial court argued, and think about the Quinlan sliding scale.
The Bouvet trial court argued this. Yes, she has a pretty high, maybe food and hydration is a high intervention, but her prognosis is still very good. 20 years, the end of the story is she's still alive. So not only did she have, you know, 20 years in 1986, apparently she's had 25 already. So they were not wrong that she could live a very long time. So using that sliding scale, the court argued her prognosis is high, so though there's a lot of intrusion, the state's interest still trumps her right to want to have her life ended. But the Court of Appeals disagreed. The Court of Appeals said she can have that feeding tube removed. And here's the legal rationale. And you'll see 10 years later how different the rationale is. And this sets us up for Cruzan, which is the 1990 Supreme Court case. The appellate court said the patient alone has the exclusive right to refuse any medical treatment or service. And it doesn't matter whether it's life prolonging or life sustaining. Doesn't matter whether you need it to live or not. It doesn't matter how long you have to live. If you don't want it and you are competent, and remember I keep saying, and you are competent, which she was, you can refuse it. Immediately, at least in the state of California, that meant that if you were Jehovah's Witness and you said, I don't want blood products, they are never going to be able to get a court order to put blood products in you, because you are saying, it doesn't matter that I will survive my earthly existence by blood products. Jehovah's Witness believe that they could have eternal damnation by that act of taking foreign blood. And so they can refuse blood products even if they have a very long trajectory and very curable disease. No longer a sliding scale approach where the decision hinges at all on either invasion or prognosis. Now, this is California, of course, but that means a big departure and a big shift, so that to the point now where, and this is reaffirmed in the Supreme Court case in 1990, it wouldn't have been without a Supreme Court case, it wouldn't have gone 50 statewide, but to the point today where you couldn't, it's orthodoxy now in every nursing and medical school that you will not impose on the Jehovah's Witness. If there's any clinical ethics case in a nursing or a medical school curriculum, it's going to involve the Jehovah's Witness. And it's always going to have a very clear answer. If they're confident, no, you can't refuse. The trial court said, we shouldn't be, the appellate court said of the trial court, you're attaching too much importance to time and not enough importance to quality of life. And they argued, that should have at least equal, if not more, sway. The court also argued this is entirely in the realm of patient decision-making, not the right at all for physicians. Huge shift from the way that the original trial court in the Quinlan case had argued. And they argued it's just not relevant that removing the feeding tube will kill her. It's not relevant, just like not getting blood products is not relevant for Jehovah's Witness. They quote a 1972 California case, Cobbs versus Grant. A person of adult years and in sound mind has the right, in the exercise of control over his own body, to determine whether or not to submit to medical treatment. And then the appellate court builds on that. This will be the core of the reasoning in Cruzan. The right to refuse medical treatment is basic and fundamental. It's recognized as part of the right to privacy, 14th Amendment, protected by both the state of California's constitution and the federal constitution. And its exercise, the right to privacy, its exercise requires no one's approval. It is a moral and philosophical decision that being a competent adult is Bouvet's alone. It speaks to the broadening of Quinlan, even though this is a California case and that was a New Jersey case, and we're going to see that 4 years later. But now, we're not talking about level of invasion or prognosis. So what happened? The tube was removed. Yes.
But many people throughout the Bouvet case had argued that the reason that she wanted to die wasn't because she was terminally ill, that her situation was hopeless, but that she was getting very bad care. That her nausea, that her inability to take in nutrients, that her inability to have her pain controlled, was a failure on the part of the clinical team's approach to her care and not an inherent situation in the physical illness that she was experiencing. And the case's attention actually got folks who were more palliative care minded. Palliative care, I'm speaking anachronistically because palliative care is not a 1980s kind of institution, but the mindset of let's work on symptoms, let's see if we can give her better care, let's see if we can improve the quality of her life.
And that's what they actually did. And so she started to take in a liquid diet. After this court case, she wins the right to die. She decides, I'm getting better care and I'm actually not interested in dying anymore. And she starts to get pain management, and she's actually still alive. Some of the very almost chilling aspects of some of these cases is that the verdicts that get laid out ultimately may be in principle the right decisions, but may not have actually in fact been what the advocate of those verdicts really wanted. And so it's it leaves you a little bit queasy thinking that she needed better care and she would never have wanted to die, but the courts were going to let her die and today she'd be dead if they hadn't stepped in. So just something to keep in mind. Not that I'm at all speaking against the principle of having the right to decide one's destiny,
But when we get to the paper that you'll write about physician-assisted suicide, one of the concerns people often raise is, are people interested in physician-assisted suicide because they've been denied good palliative care? Or do they want it because they want it because even despite good palliative care, this is the decision that's right for them? And that's a conundrum that we really can't deny as powerful because we saw it right here in Bouvet. And we saw it very concretely.
I'm not speaking against physician-assisted suicide at all. I'm saying it is certainly not a silly argument when we've got Bouvet right in front of us.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what criteria they use to measure the competence, because you have a person who is lying and you have pain, and at that time, now she has been disposed by her husband, then you still say this person is competent.
Yes, competent in the United States is a very constrained analysis. So sometimes people will say, if you're depressed, you can't be competent, but that's actually not standard. It's an argument that's made, but it's not the way that competence is designated. So being in pain doesn't disqualify you from being competent. Being deemed competent, making a rational decision doesn't deem you incompetent. Being depressed, those do not disqualify you. Competence is basically about whether you are able to understand the decision, talk about alternatives, explain your rationale for a discrete decision. But there is a lot of bioethical and clinical debate about what constitutes competence. And there are folks who will say, if you've got this kind of a condition, you automatically ruled yourself out as competent. And one of the things people sometimes argue is, if you are suicidal, you can't be considered competent. Those are the debates that do rage. But competence, strictly speaking from a legal perspective, is very narrow. And she could say, here's the consequence, this is why I want it, this is what's been tried, these are the alternatives, that's competence. And the fact that her husband left her whatever depression, that today will rarely get you any kind of claim. In fact, a lot of times when a providing team doesn't agree with the thing that the patient would like to do, they bring in the psych consult so that the psych people can come in and deem the person incompetent. That they almost never achieve it. If that's the reason, it almost never works in the United States today. We are in a very high autonomy mode of this continuum between autonomy and paternalism, for better or worse, but that's where we tend to be.
I was just wondering if in both cases, if there would have been any legal consequences, like if the physicians had not refused to remove, or even today, like if the physician who refused to remove the fetal tumor, take the person off the ventilator.
What the physician can do is say, or nurse, whoever the practitioner is, but usually in withdrawal cases it's a physician. But if the physician says, this goes against my conscience, the physician can refuse to withdraw, but must transfer care if the court has ordered the withdrawal of care. So one can recuse on conscience grounds. Just like you don't have to perform an abortion if you're a pro-life physician. You absolutely are never going to be compelled to do it. But then you are supposed to transfer care if that's what the person wants.
And, that was true back then. Couldn't actually just go along with it and take it out. They couldn't refuse the care.
So the court said, pull the tube.
No. Before they even went to court, what would have happened if the family of the Quinlan woman said,
Quinlan or Bouvet?
Both of them. If they had said, I don't want treatment, and the doctor said, okay, go home.
That probably did happen.
So there would have been no...
No, because here's the thing. If the hospital doesn't mind, if the physician doesn't mind, if the family doesn't mind, there isn't anybody to sue.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's no legal precedent that precludes them from...
The thing is, we're going to see in the Wendland case in a couple of minutes that there are boundaries for when you can withdraw care. And it is when people are in, when the loved one. Now, Bouvet is just like you and me. That's a competent adult. The other cases, Cruzan and Wendland and Quinlan, are surrogate decision-making case. A surrogate cannot withdraw life-sustaining therapy from a patient unless the patient is terminally ill. So we're going to see in Wendland, you can't just... So, for example, my husband is an absolute scoundrel. I told him that our babysitter, he had to go travel, I told him our babysitter had to stay overnight Tuesday night because I had a very early morning meeting on Wednesday night. He told the babysitter she was supposed to stay over Wednesday night, even though today's the first day of school, and I had all the time in the world to get, you know, to get into bed. So when I called the babysitter on Tuesday night to say, you know, I'm going to be home around 10 o'clock, she said, what do you mean? I'm leaving at 8. And I live in Princeton, so I'm an hour and a half away. I said, what do you mean? You're staying overnight. No, I've got a text from Paul that says I'm staying overnight Wednesday night. Indeed, Paul had made a mistake. So now Paul is on a ventilator because he's got pneumonia. He has a very good chance of recovery. But if I withdraw it right now, I don't have to go through a divorce because now I get the inheritance. I'm the widow. I don't have to do the divorce. I want the tube out. Yeah, it's aspiration pneumonia. He's got like a 99% chance of recovery. Get it out now! No. Got to duke it out with Paul over the babysitting and everything after he's weaned. Can't there? That is for sure. So if somebody is survivable, not PBS or terminally ill, fine. But fully recoverable, you can't pull the life-sustaining therapy, even if they are, even if you want to and the physicians want to, for whatever your nefarious purposes.
Okay, we're going to see that in Wendland. All right, but now we get drumroll, Cruzan. This is the big case. And it's also got this very strange twist to it. Here's the facts. January 11th, 1983. So it's going to be 7 years later till they get a decision on this. She's going to be in a PBS state for 7 years. Cruzan loses control of her car. And when she gets to the hospital, she has a heartbeat and she can breathe on her own. It's not a ventilator case. This is a food and hydration case. But she's without oxygen for so long, she can't take in nutrients. She's in a persistent vegetative state, non-ventilator dependent. She's got reflexes, but no cognitive function. They are continuing to give her artificial nutrition and hydration. 3 years later, she's still getting artificial hydration nutrition. She has no hope of recovery. She's in a PBS state. Cruzan's parents, this is a Missouri case, starts in Missouri, ends up with the Supreme Court. Cruzan's parents petition the hospital. They say, she's been in a PBS state for 3 years. We've demonstrated that she's made not any improvement at all. She isn't going to get any better. The hospital says, absolutely not. We are not removing her food and water. Absolutely not. The trial court says, absolutely, go ahead. That sounds like a reasonable request. And Nancy Cruzan has the right to refuse death prolonging procedures.
Yes. But then it goes to the appeals process.
And the appeals process notes that there is a difference between a surrogate refusing care for someone and a patient refusing care for herself. The Supreme Court of Missouri says, absolutely not. You may not withdraw her food and hydration because we don't have any clear and convincing evidence that this is what she would want. The Supreme Court says the Constitution does not support the right of a person to refuse medical treatment in every circumstance, hearkening back to the Quinlan. And a state, they say, is allowed to have a very high evidentiary bar when it comes to surrogate decision making. And the bar that they set is clear and convincing evidence. New York, Florida, and Missouri have a bar that says, you need to show me that Susie or Tommy or Karen wanted to have withdrawal of treatment in a circumstance like this. It's got to be clear and compelling. Because, oh boy, if you get it wrong, you've actually just, you know, brought about death in this patient. If you've got clear and convincing evidence, fine. But you have to produce clear and convincing evidence. Why am I harping on this? Because the only reason the Supreme Court looked at this case at all was because the Cruzan family argued that clear and convincing evidentiary standard was unconstitutional. That was what was interesting to the Supreme Court. May a state have a bar called clear and convincing evidence? Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to who brought this? It's the family wanted. She obviously didn't.
The hospital.
And what was the hospital's state?
Same thing. The hospitals, at the time, the view is, we do not take life-sustaining therapies away from patients. We are here to heal and to cure and to sustain life. We are not here to kill them. Again, I'm being inflammatory, but that's because today we think about, there's many people who don't see a distinction, but the conventional view today is there's a difference between killing and letting
go. What was the hospital's assessment if the physician said that they were willing to go along with it? So why did the hospital have
Did the physician say that?
I thought that's what you said, that the physicians
I thought that you said that the physicians agreed that they would have, that she could, so the physicians didn't agree?
No. Okay. See, the thing is,
when physicians agree, patients agree, and families agree, nobody knows for most of the time. Sometimes you'll get the general counsel to step in and say, ah, no.
Right, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, but not in this case. No.
Mm-hmm. What about cases of children? So if
totally different.
I figured too much, but I figured I would also there.
Very complicated.
So, but, you know, if the person is 17 when they get in this car accident, then 3 years later they're 20, is it now that they're over the sort of legal age of adult responsibility that they would have to have this directive? Or?
But remember, the only thing at stake here is clear, is this the next one? Is clear and convincing. By this point, if you are in a terminal, if you've got a ventilator, and you are in a terminal state, and you're pretty, and not food and hydration, but if you have a ventilator, and you are terminal, or PVS, pretty much by this time you can have your ventilator removed, even if you are a child.
I guess what I'm asking is if the person were not on a ventilator but having this
food and hydration
mm-hmm. that if you were, I don't know, 16 when you went on this food and hydration and 3 years later, okay, you're 19, you're legal age, does there need to be clear and convincing evidence because you're over the age at which your parents would necessarily have care over you?
You're saying, does clear and convincing evidence only kick in for surrogates of adults?
Yeah.
It would be interesting to look back at the history and see what the pediatric law would be about PVS state children, food and hydration. I don't know.
Okay.
And we should look. That would be interesting. Does anybody know?
No, I think somebody has an accident at age 14 and the parents are deemed to be a surrogate, legal surrogate, and the patient survives through the age 18, 19, I think the legal the appointment of a legal surrogate prolongs as long as the patient survives.
Yeah, but I think the question is, what if the child were 5, for example? So I don't know that we have the answer here. Mm-hmm. So let's look it up and let's bring it back for next week. Okay. Somebody do that work so we can get through Wendlin, because I'm running out of time. It's an excellent question. Let's figure it out. And I'm not a pediatric clinical ethicist, so I don't know. So let's figure it out. I mean, certainly with ventilator, it seems quite clear to me, as long as the situation is terminally ill. In fact, physicians routinely at CHOP, for example, in end-stage illness, will be saying, should we sign a DNR? Should we think about withholding and withdrawing treatment in terminal illness? So, but I don't know that artificial hydration, and I don't know where artificial hydration and nutrition fits in, but it won't be hard to find out. So let's do that. Let's find out exactly. So the case goes to the Supreme Court. Now, remember that the Supreme Court's interest is in the clear and convincing evidentiary bar and whether that's constitutional. So actually, the Supreme Court says the Missouri court is correct. They are allowed to have a clear and convincing evidentiary bar. So, in fact, the Cruzan family actually loses. It's one of the weird twists. The 14th Amendment, right to privacy, does not force a state to have a low evidentiary bar. Sure, Autumn, deciding for herself, will tell you what she wants, and that's her right to privacy. But when you're deciding for Autumn, you can't claim that it's Autumn's right to refuse treatment just on hearsay, if the state thinks, I want to know that that's what Autumn wanted. If Autumn's making the decision for Autumn, very clear. If you're making the decision for Autumn, a state is allowed to ask you for some good proof. That's what the Supreme Court decided, and that meant they said to the Cruzan family, no, you may not withdraw hydration and nutrition. Now, you know that this is a withdrawal of hydration and nutrition case, so something else must have happened, and it did. All I want to do is point out that the Cruzan family lost the Cruzan case. That's the odd part of this. But this is what they say. The Supreme Court says it is absolutely a liberty right of Autumn to refuse any type of treatment, including food and hydration. And we cannot make distinctions between ventilators on the one hand and food and hydration on the other. This is the case that brings food, hydration, and ventilator into the same category.
And that's monumental. And you know how monumental it is because Terry Schiavo hinged on trying to rip apart those two types of medical care. The Schiavo case tried to get the Supreme Court to revisit the Cruzan decision and peel apart ventilator in the one hand and food and hydration on the other. And the Supreme Court, despite being under the Bush administration and a very conservative court, said, we already spoke on that. And we said, hydration and food and ventilator are the same based on Cruzan 1990, and the court refused to hear the Schiavo case. Those of you who might have been too young or not here, Terry Schiavo was a woman in a persistent vegetative state. She needed food and hydration. She did not need ventilator support. Her husband had cared for her for something like 10 years. He did not see, she was not getting any, she had a, she was in a persistent vegetative state. Her situation was never going to improve. He wanted to have food and hydration removed. That was legal, according to Cruzan. Her parents stepped in and created a national movement to save Terry Schiavo. They're the Schindlers. They argue Terry Schiavo wants to live. She makes nods and blinks. When they actually did the autopsy, they found that her brain had shrunk to the size of like a walnut, so she was not doing any responsive nodding. That doesn't take away the moral point that they did. They were Catholic. They did not want food and hydration removed. This is when the Pope speaks and says, hydration and food, that's not the same thing as the ventilator. That's what the Catholic Church, the Pope, you know, the hierarchy, says. That's not what the Supreme Court said. So, and the Supreme Court stuck to their guns, and they didn't move on it.
So, ultimately, what happens with the Cruzan case is that the decision about whether to remove food and hydration gets kicked back to the Missouri court. So they don't. The Supreme Court says, I'm not speaking about Cruzan. All I'm saying to you is, one, Missouri's allowed to have a high bar. If you're going to take something like this away from a patient, we got to know that's what the patient wants. Absolutely, if that's what the patient wants, number two, the patient can have food, hydration, or ventilator removed. But the state is allowed to decide what kind of proof do you need. That's not an overburdening of the victim. That's what the Supreme Court said. So it gets kicked back to the state of Missouri. The court says this, talking about food and hydration now, working on the really critical part for bioethics, is the food and hydration being exactly the same as ventilator. The principle that a competent person has a constitutionally protected liberty interest, that's the 14th Amendment, in refusing unwanted medical care may be inferred from our prior decisions. Griswold, Roe, on and on. The U.S. Constitution would grant a competent person a constitutionally protected right to refuse life-saving hydration and nutrition like in Bouvet. Absolutely, the court stands behind Bouvet. The right to be free from medical attention without consent to determine what shall be done with one's own body is deeply rooted in the nation's traditions. No material distinction can be drawn between the treatment to which Nancy Cruzan continues to be subject, artificial nutrition and hydration, and any other medical treatment. Artificial delivery of food and water is regarded as medical treatment by the medical profession. When a person is unconscious, both a respirator and an artificial feeding device serve to support or replace normal bodily functions. Now, food, hydration, and ventilator, all of a piece, applies to every state. It doesn't matter whether you are refusing life-sustaining or life-saving treatment. If you're competent, you can refuse all of it. No distinction between ventilator and artificial nutrition and hydration. So what happens? Well, back in the hands of the trial court, surprising how many witnesses come forward. Oh, yes, absolutely. We were at a party 5 years ago, and she was sitting there, and she said, my God, if I'm ever in a car accident because I've had too much to drink and I'm on a feeding tube, you just pull that right out. People came out of the woodwork for clear and convincing evidence, which never existed prior. And then the trial court said, okay, fine, that's clear and compelling evidence. All these people coming and witnessing. I, by the way, make sure that just in case I end up in a car accident in the state of New York or Missouri, every class I teach, I am here to tell you, if I'm in the situation where I'm PBS and artificial hydration nutrition is what they're giving me, you are my witnesses. Pull that plug. Unless, of course, Tommy and Ben need me to be kept alive so that they can get the Penn tuition benefits when they finally get out of elementary school. Because I've worked here so long, they get Penn tuition regardless of whether I'm dead or alive. Do you have it? You ready? So if it happens to me, you come forward. I teach 100 people a semester. So I've got the clear and convincing evidentiary bar. The hospital didn't care at that point. They're like, whatever. And they took it out. And she died in 1990. I got one more case to do. And this is a case that's really important because it answers, it at least addresses the question many of you are asking. How far can you go?
Paul screwed it up with the babysitter. He's got pneumonia. Can we just withdraw? The Wendland case was, it's a California case, but it's a big test case of how far can you go? And the court, at least the California court, but it seems like other courts really followed suit, is not that far. If the person is not terminally ill, regardless of quality of life, the Wendland decision says you cannot withdraw life-sustaining therapies for someone else. If I'm competent, I can get you to withdraw the care for me, but I can't get you to withdraw it on Paul if he is not terminally ill or in a persistent vegetative state.
The line has to be that you are at end-stage illness or PVS. And that line got drawn very sharply, at least for California, as I said, with many other states making statutes to say this. For example, Pennsylvania has a very clear statute that says you must be at, and it's worded, but it's basically terminally ill, end stage, to make a surrogate decision. And the patient has to be unconscious and unable to, and incompetent, not able to be woken up and make a decision before a surrogate can withdraw life-sustaining therapy. So many states put statutes into place that are very similar and parallel to the Wendland court decision. So after all, if you get a statute in place and it's not questioned as constitutional, you forestall the lawsuits that push at the law. So, 1993, Robert Wendland was in a serious auto accident. He was in a coma, not PVS. He actually regained consciousness. So first he was in coma, and you can wake up from coma, not PVS, but coma, and he did. He woke up. But he was very disabled, physically and mentally. And after several years, his wife and daughters requested that his feeding tube be removed. He wasn't getting any better, and he was profoundly mentally and physically disabled. But Schiavo, 5 years earlier, his mother and his sister said, absolutely not. You are not going to kill our son and brother. So here's the legal battle. The trial court applied the clear and convincing evidence standard and said, do we know for sure that Wendland would want this? Because if we have clear and compelling evidence that Wendland would want this, that he would not want to live with this kind of physical or mental disability, then we can withdraw his food and hydration, if that's what he said. But the bar has got to be clear and compelling evidence. So the other thing I tell everybody is this. If I cannot give a philosophy class, if I don't have this kind of mental competence, go ahead and take the feeding tube out, unless, of course, my disability is kicked in and my kids are getting the Penn benefits. And you always see the clause, right? Once they're out of college, believe me, if I can't give a philosophy class, you just go ahead. That should function as the clear and compelling evidence, because, again, I tell 100 people a year. And besides that, if you really want somebody to be able to pull the plug whenever they want to pull the plug, get a healthcare proxy, because that person speaks as soon as you are not competent. So that's what I've got. So don't tell Paul how mad I am about the stupid babysitter. At any rate, the point is that the trial court says, you don't have any clear and compelling evidence. He never told anybody that, oh, I wouldn't want to live with this kind of mental disability. You don't have any evidence. This is just what you want or what you think he would want. And even if you're right that that's what he would want, I got to have proof. The Court of Appeals said, no, they can withdraw food and hydration. Obviously, this is not the end of the story. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial court and said no. You have to have clear and compelling evidence to take life support away from somebody who is only disabled and not terminally ill. The patient's not terminally ill, not PVS, not even comatose. The person's conscious and has no health care proxy. Get one, folks. No health care proxy and no written instructions. Various surrogates are disagreeing about what he would want, so it's not clear and compelling, obviously, or they would all be on the same page and they're not. Under these circumstances, the surrogate may not withhold artificial nutrition and hydration absent clear and convincing evidence that the conservator's decision is in accordance with either the conservatee's own wishes or, then you've got to prove, best interest. But best interest, being dead, is not something Americans are real hip to believe. So, they were very careful. This does not speak to cases of PVS, comatose, or terminally ill. We emphasize that the clear and convincing standard does not apply to the vast majority of healthcare decisions made by surrogates, conservators, under the California statute. And that's the end of the story. So, questions on that? Got a couple of minutes, and then I'll get the watch back. So what we've done tonight is talk about the withdrawal of life-sustaining therapy, both ventilator and food and hydration. That gets us to the point where people are saying that it's the natural question, if you can have life support withdrawn, why can't you then have a prescription that will accomplish the same thing for competent patients? One of the things that we spent a lot of time tonight talking about surge decision-making. Physician-assisted suicide in the United States is always, is always about a competent patient deciding for herself. It is never about surrogates deciding for others. In the Netherlands, where they have a euthanasia law, people can decide for others in very constrained circumstances. But the entire debate in the United States is about Autumn as a competent individual who's saying, if I can have my food and hydration removed, if I can have my ventilator removed, why can't I have barbiturates in the same end-of-life terminally ill situation? And that's where we're going to pick it up next week, where we look at the first court case, which is, let me just see which one we're looking at first. We're looking at the Washington versus Glucksberg case. And using the Washington versus Glucksberg case, we're going to read a very famous article by James Rachel, which was published in the New England Journal, classic argument. And when the court gave their decision, the Supreme Court, they actually knew their Rachels. And when the court gave their decision, Vacco versus Quill, they knew their Dworkin. So the next 2 weeks, we're going to do Rachel's classic piece and Dworkin's classic piece, and looking at the Supreme Court's decision to affirm the Oregon law, but not to federalize the right to physician-assisted suicide, which is where we stand now. States have the right to make that decision. We do not have a federally protected right to PAS. And your argument for the paper for the class is going to be, will we be better off or worse off if we federalize? That's what your task will be. Any questions? Thoughts, comments? All right. See you in a week.